Achieving a gorgeous grin from home isn't a total mystery with BiteClear aligners. Just don't be surprised if all of your sleuthing friends start asking, "What's your secret?" Begin by ordering your at-home impression kit today for only $14.95. BiteClear aligners are doctor-directed and delivered to your door. Treatment costs thousands less than braces. Plus, they offer flexible financing, accept eligible insurance, and you can pay with your HSA FSA. Get 80% off your impression kit when you use code WONDERY at Byte.com. That's BYTE.com. Start your confidence journey today with Byte.
Welcome to Kotaku Split Screen, the only podcast that compares you to a kiss from a rose on the gray. It's October 17th, 2019, and we've got a lot of games and news to cover. First up, Maddie and I talk a bit more about Destiny 2, then I rave about Cyanore, Wild Hearts, and Disco Elysium. We then talk a bit more about the ongoing Blizzard China debacle, discuss Fortnite's Black Hole Blackout, and share more of your weird, non-essential video game traditions. We close out with some off-topic discussion of books, because books are good and reading is fundamental. Educated, Green Mars, Why the Last Man, and some bonus Watchmen, too. It's a great show. Stick around. And welcome back to the show. It is raining in Portland, but hopefully sunny wherever you are. My name is Kirk Hamilton, and I'm so glad that you joined us yet again. And of course, I am joined by my co-host, Maddie Myers. Hello, Maddie. How's it going?
Hello, Kirk. It's going pretty well. It is not raining here, but it's not as sunny as I'd like it to be.
Yeah, that's it's kind of a middle ground. I know how you feel. It's almost never as sunny as I would like it to be. I guess this is that time of year where the weather turns bad and the video games all start coming out.
And it gets dark really quickly, and it's time to just settle in to your couch and play some video games, because like it's already dark at 6:15, so it's why not? Why not boot up those games?
Bask in the glow of your TV screen and all these virtual worlds that we can visit. We have got a lot to talk about on this show. Let's talk about video games first.
Sure.
Let's talk about some games. What are you playing?
I'm playing the same games that I've been playing for weeks now, and I've just been rotating between Destiny 2 and Borderlands 3 and Fire Emblem, which all feel incredibly huge and like places that I'm just visiting for a few hours per day, according to which location I feel like visiting. And this week it was mostly Destiny 2. And so this is my first time playing an MMO. And there are a lot of things about Destiny 2 that are probably very basic observations from me as a result of that, because I feel like I've played these kind of big lifestyle games in other genres, but not one that is literally designed to be a part of your life in the way that I've made it so that Borderlands can be that kind of game by just treating it as such in past cases. But it's not like you can treat the game that way. You can live in there and just do every side quest and act like it's an MMO, but it's not really. Destiny is like
kind of different.
You, as Joshua Rivera was saying last week, like you can design your hot rod of a character and like just endlessly fine tune them. And that is what the game rewards. So a few things I've noticed about that. The quests are short and they sometimes end on a weird cliffhanger. And that's really funny to me, because it's like you're in the middle of doing something, but it's like as though Destiny 2 itself is like, you've only got like 45 minutes and we're just going to wrap this quest on up. We're going to throw a boss at you and then you're going to have to fly to a completely other planet to do the next thing in this quest, which is going to pick up precisely where you left off story-wise, but you could stop here. It's like as though the game is designed to be played in these like discrete chunks of time that also happen to overlap very well with like my life and my friends' lives, where like I can invite someone in to like play a quest with me and then they're like, I gotta go do something else, but I'm just gonna do this one quest, and then I can just slot some other person in, or like I can leave and that other person can then just be like, I'm gonna do two more Destiny quests. It's weird. It's like some sort of weird planning technique that this game has created for how it operates.
Let me ask you, just for clarity's sake, when you talk about the quests that are short that you're doing, these are like
the
story missions?
I'm doing all the Red Legion missions,
Okay, so you're working through story missions.
And they're all so discreetly like designed. It's like a little meal, like a little snack that you have. And you're like, well, that was just the right amount of video game. Is the whole game not like this? And if I were to do other...
So the game is both like that and not like that. The way that you're playing is interesting because you're kind of like, you're like playing through all of these separate story campaigns that most people have already played through and like don't have a reason to play through again.
Yeah.
But if you just came to the game new, it would be like this smorgasbord laid out before you of just all these cool little story quests that you can
Or like little snacks that I can just be like, oh, I'll have a little of this.
And you can do them in any order too, right? Like the Mercury stuff or the Mars stuff. Like it's all kind of the same level and it doesn't really matter where you start it, which is also cool because if you played them in order, you know, you got a new location with the new, you know, missions and you would just do all those missions usually pretty quickly in like a few hours. But having them all, it's just sort of like, oh, what story do I want to play today?
Yeah.
Which is an interesting experience, I would imagine.
But it's also, at least so far, true that many activities in Destiny are like a pretty reasonable length of time, which I guess is both great and dangerous because it sort of lends itself to allowing you to feel like this game could easily slot into your life, which it totally could. You could play it for an hour a day and just like get some bounties or whatever and get whatever you were going to get and then log the heck off. But you can also just do one more thing, which is just sort of an ongoing problem I have that I've described many times on this show and is continually my downfall in pretty much every game I like, where I'm like, I'm just going to do one more thing. And then it's 2 in the morning and I realize that I've ruined my own life. So it's great and terrible. And I don't know, it's just, it's given me a lot to think about because I just, my girlfriend's out of town again. So I've got a lot of alone time this past week. And so I'm like very much plunged directly into the heart of like, I'm just going to play a bunch of side quests and quests in a game. And I'm going to be inside the whole time. And I'm not necessarily going to take great care of myself while I'm engaging in these pastimes. And it's also sort of brought me back to the period of time in my life when I was doing that with Borderlands, the first two, it was like not a high point for me. Like it, like I can sort of look back on that and be like, oh yeah, like that was a time when I was spending hundreds of hours on a game. And that's kind of like gamer street cred, as it were, where you're like, yeah, I remember spending hundreds of hours
playing
a video
game.
I've done that.
And it's like, but at this point I feel like I try not to do that anymore, but it feels so good, but not in a good way. Like I don't know.
That's funny. It's the way that your life circumstances can fit in with the way that you play a game can be very interesting and very and awfully varied. I mean, you can play a game like Destiny for so many different reasons. I think back to the first Destiny when Destiny first came out.
Yeah.
And I was covering it for Kotaku. I was fresh off a breakup and was very, very single
at the
time.
Perfect timing, man.
Yeah. And I was so ready to just be single and play the fuck out of this game. And that is exactly what I did. And it was great. I mean, it was very good for that. It filled this time in my life where I was like not feeling super social, was kind of bummed and just wanted a thing to play. And then it was this very fun game for that. And, you know, then you can have the I'm alone for this week. And so I have time to kill. And then you kind of get in that same mind space of doing that. I guess I've found with Destiny, it's tricky to fit. I think I, like you were saying, I so quickly can start to lapse into just do the next thing. It is a very like modular game. Like I'm thinking of the last big thing I did in the game, which I haven't really actually played it in about in a week, was that this big exotic weapon quest that you get in Shadowkeep that... It took me a very long time to finish it, probably like 10 hours or something, maybe 6 hours over the course of the weekend, maybe only like 5, I don't know. Sometimes it feels like 10 hours and it was really only like 4 hours, but
or vice versa.
It took a lot of time over the weekend. And it was a bunch of just discrete steps that were all, you can just do them whenever you want. The quest doesn't expire ever. You just have it in your quest log. And it's, you know, kill 5 of these things and then do this challenge on the moon and then do this thing. And you could just do one. You could log in every night and just play the one and then log out. I think I, you know, it's, there's so much discussion of Destiny right now in terms of our own behavior and our, the way that we, you know, interact with it rather than the design of the game.
Yeah.
And I think that's because
the design of the game allows you to think about it in that exact way, or encourages you to think about it in that exact way. Like I was you know, unlocking one of those things where it's like, get 30 kills with such and such type of weapon, like explosive weapons or whatever it may be. And I realized I had 3 left and I was like, oh, cool. Like, I'll just stay up even later and like go quickly get these 3 things.
Those passive things.
But in the course of doing that, I of course was starting another quest and being like, well, all right, I may as well finish this out. I've already like achieved this arbitrary goal that the game has set for me. And then at that point, I'm already looking at my menus. I'm like, what else is like about to unlock? Because it's so satisfying to click on these little boxes and hear a sound play while I'm like unlocking a thing. And then
Well, and especially once you unlock the thing, I mean, there's a Destiny experience that I have had many times, which is staying up too late to finally finish a quest that rewards me with a really cool gun that I then at 1:30 or 2 in the morning
need to go use.
So then I'm like, ah, it's so cool. It shoots, you know, cluster Nova bombs, this rocket launcher I got or whatever. And then you wind up kind of going and messing with that. And that's very easy to fall into something else, which is totally the game that people really want to play. And I actually completely get that. I'd say the one thing that I've found for Destiny over the last week is more and more people who are, you know, really hardcore Destiny players, in particular Datto, who's the YouTuber who covers Destiny, has been on the show a few times. And it's just like, he's like the very hardcore nuts and bolts Destiny YouTuber.
Yeah.
And he's put out his impressions. I've read, like, I guess Ryan at Polygon ran his review, which is interesting because he's a super hardcore player as well. And seeing what people who have put, you know, all like 100 hours into the game at this point are getting out of it has been very interesting for me since I haven't had that time to put into it. But I appreciate that point of view since I used to be that person. Like, the armor system sounds really cool. If you're a hardcore player, you can like finally really customize your stats, and I think people are really psyched about that. And the season pass is interesting too. What have you been, interacting with that or feeling much of a reaction to that?
It's only recently that it started to give me the little notification that's like, look at your season's thing and click on things there that will then achieve a thing that I don't understand what it is. So Destiny, okay, so as
really.
A new, so not really, but only because I actually blame Destiny for not really bothering to explain how a lot of that stuff works. Okay, so there's a skill tree in Destiny, friggin' obviously, where you can select what kind of melee attack you have. The game doesn't tell you that information. Like, I didn't even know that I could change that until one of my friends was like, did you know that you can change your melee attack?
Yeah, are those all unlocked for you already when you started? Can you just get all of those?
Some of them are. I think I can get more later, but again, I don't even know the answer to that because the game's not telling me, but there's like 2 different diamond...
Yeah. This is definitely an example of a weird thing where they had to reverse engineer the progression for you, because for most players, they went through the progression really logically, but now you're getting everything at once, so it's like not clear what you can unlock and what you can't.
There's also just a lot of granular stuff the game doesn't explain. Like, it took me a while to figure out that the grenade is not, I don't have a certain number of grenades, it just recharges. No. It's a magical grenade that I always have according to time and not according to carrying around a number of grenades.
Though sometimes you'll get a piece of gear that will give you 2 grenades because it has grenades on it, and then that is somewhat confusing when it comes to the lore.
I can't wait to pick up one of those items and now I'll understand it as opposed to being really confused by it, which I was. Or like, you know, I can create a shield and the game didn't tell me that. We were talking
shield
about that
great.
In G-Chat the other day. You were like referring to that and I was like, oh yeah, I have seen people do that. Can I do that? And then I checked and I was
There's the bubble and the class ability shield.
The other shield,
which they just nerfed. Like, so they just buffed the bubble, so you'll get the buffed bubble, the
Can't
Titan
wait.
Bubble.
Can't
but
wait for that buff
the
bubble,
The rally
baby.
Barricade, that used to automatically reload your gun, and that's like this whole big thing that they just changed. All the auto reload
perks
are
I don't know the difference.
Gone.
I was more just like, y'all didn't even tell me I had this shield. Like, I did not know it existed. Like, there's kind of a tutorial in Destiny, but not really. Like, they're like, press Q to throw a grenade. We're not going to tell you any more information about the grenade or like how it works. Just press Q, I guess. Anyway, bye. Like, that's the extent of the information that you're getting. And I don't know. But you also, I'm benefiting from all of these other changes, like the fact that I can look at my inventory and see every possible number that's affiliated with a gun, which is also an activity I could already do in Borderlands 3. So it really allows you to just plunge full tilt into finding out what every statistic means, which is that not something that you could do before? You couldn't see the numbers on like impact and stability and accuracy and
you
blah, blah.
You could. I think they didn't always have numbers. Like, the numbers were always there, but I think that now they're showing the numbers and you can see them on the stats, but it used to just be bars. For a while, it was just bars and you could compare the 2 bars and you would see higher impact on one gun than another.
Right.
But now I guess it shows numbers. Those numbers were always there. And if you go to websites like destiny.db, they have an index on on every single weapon with the numbers written down. Mm-hmm. And you can see that. Similarly, like Destiny Item Manager is this super great third-party app. These people have been making and running, like a whole team of people make it. And it's amazing. Have you used Destiny Item Manager?
I haven't, but I am completely believing that it exists. That seems like a third-party tool that some people would make to help you organize your Destiny wallet.
Yeah, it kind of comes from a period of the game when there were all these third-party tools because the game didn't do stuff for you. Like, you didn't used to be able to easily manage your inventory through the web app, like through the actual Bungie app, mm-hmm. but there was an open API that let you do it. So I think I actually wrote a Kotaku article about this way back when I was just writing about everything in Destiny, about Destiny Item Manager. It's really good, and it lets you do... It's good for if you're ultra-hardcore in particular, like if you have three characters and you need to transfer items between them, which you'll need to do a lot if you have multiple characters. The game does not make that easy. There's no in-game way to do it. You have to like go to your vault in the tower, leave the weapon. Then this is what you had to do actually at the beginning of Destiny is you would leave the weapon in your vault, then log in as the other character, go to the vault, get it out.
Take it out. Yeah.
Ridiculous. So Destiny Item Manager makes that possible, but it also lets you, you know, what's my highest possible power level? And you can just like click a button and it'll automatically equip it and do that kind of thing, which the game doesn't quite do yet, but the game is getting closer to building that kind of functionality in, which is nice, I think, especially for people who have a lot of stuff to manage.
It is nice. And I mean, I also don't know that I'm playing this game or any of the other games I listed in the way that they're quote unquote meant to be played, in part because I'm playing these games at the same time, which is probably healthier in the sense that it's forcing me to not directly engage with any of them enough that it becomes a problem for me, because it's like I'm playing all these different lifestyle games, but I'm forcing myself to not play any of them as a lifestyle. But I don't know. I guess as a result of that, I don't really feel like I'm getting the full Destiny experience in the way that perhaps a Destiny-minded listener might hope I would be, because I'm still just playing it casually. But that's something you can do. Maybe that's good news, I think, for someone.
No, I think that that's totally one of the versions of the full Destiny experience. Like, the full Destiny experience isn't just playing it so much that you lose track of yourself and it becomes problematic.
I think that's just if you want to be good, quote-unquote, or, like, have a high level. But
that is, I mean, it's funny. I look back on the way that I played Destiny in that way, and there are like these articles that are cries for help on Kotaku where I'm literally writing, like, I'm playing this game too much and need to stop. And that was a conscious thing I even did at the time. Okay, I'm going to let myself become addicted to an MMO for this month and see how it goes. And it didn't go great, Maddie. It didn't go great. And
so,
you know, but I do look back on that sometimes with that kind of, I was joking earlier about, oh, I was in the shit, you know, I was there. But there is that feeling. And I think most MMOs have this feeling of, even if you were just addicted to it at one point, or you played it that much at one point, you kind of have those things. Oh yeah, I remember grinding for Gjallarhorn or going to the gunsmith to try to get a perfect roll on my hopscotch pilgrim. And you tell these stories, and the people know because there's this shared language that anyone who was there kind of shares. And it's like an enabling thing. Everybody like enabled one another's unhealthy gameplay, and so now we all kind of relish in the fact that that happened. But I think that playing it regular, like at a more casual way, is totally chill, as evidenced by all the people that I'll hear from, even when we talk about it on the show, who write in and say, oh yeah, I play the game that way. It's a totally fun way to play. So
yeah, and I know that when I was starting, there were at least a few listeners who were like, I'm curious if the game can even be played casually and if it's like possible to hop back in. And I would say from my vantage point, it's still totally possible. I kind of understand the story thanks to Kirk and like a few other people over the course of playing who've explained it to me as we went along, but it's not really something I'm getting out of it per se. I'm more
It's not the main draw.
Getting the other dopamine itch scratching out of it, which is not the worst reason to play a video game. I think part of my guilt about the story is like, I can't just play a game for the sake of the dopamine, right? Like, maybe that's bad. Like, I'm not supposed to do that, right? I'm supposed to be like, you know, doing my homework and caring about a story in a game. But I don't really care about Destiny's story or Borderlands' story for that matter. That's not really why I'm playing either one of those games. I'm playing them because it feels good, man. It feels good to play those games.
I completely get what you mean in terms of story, just because when I think it was, gosh, I don't even remember what it was. Maybe a Nintendo game, or I guess it was Outer Wilds. Maybe that was the one.
Sure.
And just playing a game, or I guess Metro as well. Some of these games I played earlier this year, Metro Exodus, where I was mostly into the story and I just wanted to know what happened next.
Yeah.
And it was this striking feeling of, oh, That's why I'm playing, and I'm not playing because I want to level up my gun in whatever. In Metro Exodus, you know, there's an upgrade system in that game. You can kind of upgrade your shit. Mm-hmm. And then Outer Wilds is such a good example of a kind of very starkly not that game. You never upgrade anything, and that's the point. And so you're just playing for the story, and it's cool. Like that, you know, that feeling. And then it can be kind of jarring when you realize, oh, I totally am not playing this game to find out what happens next. Yeah, I'm just playing because of the dopamine hit, as you described.
Yeah, but I guess I'm telling myself that's okay for now. It's okay for me to be doing this.
Sure.
It's all good.
Fun.
Anyway, what are you playing?
Oh man, okay. So I've got a couple of games. First of all, let's start with one is a weird game that I just started playing yesterday that is completely wild and I'm excited to tell you and listeners about. That's called Disco Elysium. I'll talk about that in a minute. First, though, is Sayonara Wild Hearts, which I mentioned a few weeks ago because it was on Apple Arcade and I had played a little bit of it and said it was very good. I played the whole game, I finished it, and it is amazing. It is a masterpiece. Like, it is like so good. Like, I am blown away by how good it is. Something's changed, and I didn't know you're slipping away. It's like, man. So this game is a music game. It's made by Simogo, who are the makers of like Your Walk and Device 6, both really cool games with really cool music. But this game is, they call it almost an interactive pop album. And the music is done by, let me find the credits here. Oh, it's by Daniel Olson and Jonathan Ng, who both were involved with Simogo. Jonathan Ng actually wrote a really cool song that was in Device 6 that just plays in this one really random hidden part of that game. That's a really cool game also. If listeners haven't played that, it's a phone game. But they're both great musicians. And then Linnea Olson is the singer on this, who I'm guessing is Daniel Olson's wife or maybe sister. And I'm at least guessing they're related. And this music, oh my god, the music is so, so good. It sounds, it's very Churches inspired. It's some of the songs sound a little bit like the Cardigans, if the Cardigans met the Churches. It's that kind of a sound, which is like I love that aesthetic, the music. Uh-huh. And then it's this rich, you know, crimson, red, colorful aesthetic that matches just like pulsing, you know, with the music. And oh my God, like the last couple levels of this game destroyed me. They were so good. I was like emotionally wrecked by this game by the end of it, just because it was so beautiful. It wasn't even like, the story's really cool. It's about this woman who has her heart broken, and then she falls into this sort of ethereal realm and has to conquer these beings and in these wild, you know, kind of racing, fighting. I don't even know. It's kind of like Rez in that way. You're just constantly flying forward and transitioning to these new areas and new mechanics. It's like always throwing new ideas at you while the music is changing. And the story is really cool, but it's more that just people made something this beautiful. I mean, it is like freaking rad, and I can't recommend it enough, especially because like people can play it for free on their phone. I played it with a controller, which I'd recommend, but it's also on PS4, also on Switch. I think I might buy it on Switch, honestly, like just again, partly because I want to give these people money for making something so cool.
I think this was the game that I used as an example when we talked about Apple Arcade, where I was like, this game seems really cool and I want to buy it, so I might just buy it on Switch myself because I've heard so many good things about it. It sounds really,
oh my
really
gosh.
Good.
Yeah, so. I think you'll really like it. So, you know, I don't know. There's not like a whole deep analysis of it or anything. It's just like one of the coolest games I've played in a very long time, and I found it moving and beautiful and great, and I think people should play it. So that's Sayonara Wild Hearts. Very good. Okay, so Disco Elysium. Let me try to tell you about this game. So Jason and I just started texting about this yesterday. I had heard of it a little bit and had forgotten it was coming out. He had never heard of it and just texted me like, what is this game? And I thought, oh yeah, I remember that, and kind of looked it up on Steam and remembered seeing it because it looks very, you know, isometric PC RPG, like looks like Planescape Torment and Divinity Original Sin 2. So that was kind of what had attracted me to it when I first heard about it. So then I saw the reviews of this. This game has very, very positive reviews that, you know, PC Gamer and Rock Paper Shotgun have both written very nice things about it. Started reading about it thinking, oh, okay, this is even more interesting than I thought. Downloaded it and started playing it. And what the hell? This game is wild. This is like the wildest, I think probably the wildest RPG I've played since I can remember in terms of how it works. So, okay, let me try to explain how it works.
Is it bad, good, wild, or good wild?
Good wild. Very okay, cool. Good wild. Very ambitious and creative and just wild. So I'm very early okay. in this game. I played a couple of hours. So these are initial impressions. It could be that turns out it's terrible.
It's all
going to
change. It's
going
to get even more wild after the first 2 hours.
I think that maybe it is. So this game, so for starters, this game is made by a studio called Zaum. I think it's Z-A-U-M Studio. The lead writer and lead designer is a guy named Robert Kurvitz, who I've seen some interviews with and read a little bit. He's been working on this game for 15 years. They have been Whoa. Making this game. So that's what they say, 15 years. And when you start playing it, so that should give you just some sense of like where we're going here. This okay. game is legit wild. So, okay, the closest comparison I can make is Planescape Torment. I would say that Planescape Torment is like where this game draws its DNA from, in that it's very, very text heavy. It's mm-hmm. a role-playing game in the truest sense of the word. It's all about playing a role as a person. And it takes that using the power of text because it can go inside and do an inner monologue and like have all of these very complicated stat check interactions. It's just not like any other RPG you've played that looks like this. So, okay, let's see. Premise first. All right. It's kind of like a steampunk detective game. You're playing a specific character. He's this guy who wakes up completely hungover with no memory of where he is in this hotel room.
Classic noir setup.
Classic noir setup. In this hotel room, there's been a murder. He is a kind of deadbeat cop who, you know, at that point, I think you basically then just decide who he is. You can pick any of a ton of different personality traits and play him a bunch of different ways. You walk around in a kind of isometric point of view. It's very painterly looking. It's actually gorgeous. The art looks really cool. And I don't know much about the world because, like I said, I've only played a little bit. But it's very local. I get the feeling the whole game maybe takes place in this one district of the city, and you're trying to solve crimes and talk to people, and there's probably a whole big story as you're investigating things. It's very, very text heavy. It's kind of like interactive fiction meets an isometric game. It's extremely like all takes place during text. So there is voice acting, which so far I'd say is pretty mixed. Like there's some of the acting is good, some isn't. It has all the hallmarks of a game that was made by a kind of small studio mm-hmm. over a long period of time, you know, and they made stuff happen. So characters will talk a bit at first and then transition to just text. Mm-hmm. Okay, so now let me see if I can explain the wildness of this game. Your character is... his mind is its own whole collection of systems in the game, and each system is governed by statistics and roles, and you interact with it in different ways. So as a basic example, you're really hungover and kind of messed up and can't remember stuff and are like kind of a mess because you're having a tough morning. And I just played a sequence where you get on the radio, your partner comes to get you, you have a bunch of conversations with him, you go out to his car and you get on the radio to HQ. And you have to call in and tell them that you lost your badge, which is apparently a very, very big deal. Like, this is not going to be good. So a lot of this is you're learning this world as you go and what things mean, because mm-hmm. it's not, you don't know, you know, it's a different world and there are different rules. So apparently losing your badge is really bad. Like, it's worse than you would think. It's not just, oh, I lost this thing, I can get another one.
It's like losing your gun or something.
You lost your gun too, and that comes up in the conversation. Or it's like, I don't know, it's like a thing that will cause disgrace on your precinct for a generation or something. Or I don't know. So you call in, and the writing is all very funny and very good. It has this kind of distinct vibe. It's very kind of off kilter and odd, but good. And you call in and you start talking to people, and in the middle of the conversation, so you call in and you'll make like a memory check and you'll pass it, and this all happens passively, and they'll just be, you'll remember what the guy's name is, so then you can greet him by name. Then you'll have a sort of, oh man, I wrote some of this stuff down. There are all these different checks that you'll make. You'll make like an interfacing check to see if you can remember how to use the button to call in, or if you can't remember. When you're on the radio, you'll do a composure check, and it'll say composure check, trivial, passed. Like you now, and it'll give you some kind of narration. You now are kind of able to keep your composure as you talk to these people. They begin making fun of you. You have an encyclopedia skill that'll pop up and tell you as your brain like remembers something, because I'm playing a high intellect character, so mm-hmm. I'm like able to remember things. And increasingly, like the whole game is governed by these myriad, just unbelievable amount of stat checks that are happening under the hood in your character's mind. And it's all about role-playing every aspect of this person and their personality, as their own mind is like almost a foil that you're working against, and changing the flow of the conversation based on how you're doing.
So do you change those stats according to which dialogue options you select, or are you changing them manually, or it's a dice roll, or how do you know you're a high intellect character, for example?
So I picked that at the beginning. Okay. So they give you you a, they're like, you can be a whatever, a brawler, like kind of direct character or a high intellect character. And I should say, there is no normal combat in this game. This isn't like a combat RPG. There are fights, but they all play out via the same stat checks and just through text. So mm-hmm. it isn't like, you know, you're taking a critical shot and landing a hit. I think there, like, you do occasionally get in fights, but it's much more like a detective RPG. So you're trying to solve mysteries and not going out and fighting random enemies. So it's all happening under the hood, and I've picked a character who's smart, so he knows things and remembers things, and I don't think is very strong or charismatic, maybe, but you can be a smooth operator, you can be, I don't know, I'm not sure. I have a feeling that this game totally branches and everybody changes, like everything changes in relation to you, so I think that who you play as and what you do, from what I've gathered from the reviews that I've skimmed, is that makes a huge difference, and, you know, this is Andy Kelly, who wrote it up for PC Gamer, said, apparently, you don't want to exhaust every dialogue option, for example, because sometimes you'll just say some shit you shouldn't have said and make someone mad at you.
Yeah.
And then they'll remember, and then later they won't want to help you with something.
That rules, though, because many games don't do anything right. even close to that, and you're supposed to exhaust every dialogue option. If you don't, you're, like, missing out on video games.
Exactly. And so there, I think there are a lot of RPG tropes that this game completely throws out, and replaces with this completely wild system of all of these interlocking inner systems. So the roles that are happening just happen totally automatically. Like, just they'll just come up. It just happens passively because your brain is just operating. Mm-hmm. There's also a whole system of thoughts, and it's what your character is currently thinking about.
Yeah.
And you can dedicate headspace, like it's like mind space that you're dedicating to a certain subject. And if you think about an argument that someone will make to you, then you can kind of chew over it for the next little while, and you'll make progress on that thought, and you'll have new options when you go back to talk to them. This is the kind of game, it's so wild. I mean, I keep using that word, I guess, but it really feels transgressive or almost just experimental in a way that I haven't felt playing a game like this in a really long time. It's a trip, and
it sounds really cool.
It's really cool, and I'm really just scratching the surface. So, like I said, it could be this all falls apart. I don't know that much about it or like where it's going. I had kind of heard about it, and now I'm playing it, and mostly off the good buzz. But, geez, it's really freaking cool. So, if people are interested in that, I would say go read a couple things about it, watch a couple of videos or something, and see if you're into it. But I'm definitely going to keep playing it. It's not like anything I've played in a really long time, and it's very funny. I'm finding it just very entertaining and very funny so far. So
sounds really good. It sounds like it would be a more thinky Phoenix Wright or Danganronpa, like if those games had a thought system where you could think about a certain clue for a while.
Yeah, and like had a branching story. Yeah. But it does have that kind of detective feeling to it, mm-hmm. where, especially being a down and out, you know, detective who's just this kind of hungover piece of crap,
right.
like that, just playing that character and then coming up with what his mind is doing. It's like you're role playing and you're actually programming the guy's mind.
That's really cool. All right. I want to play
it. It's a trip. Yeah, nice.
I'll put everything else to the side and I'll just play that game.
Yeah, I'm sure you have plenty of time to play it. Yeah, I'll be interested as more and more people play it, just what else is possible in this game and what mm-hmm. it kind of turns out to be, since I'm just now becoming familiar with it. But I did want to share my initial impressions on it because, well, it's very cool. All right, why don't we take a break and then we'll come back with some news and some listener mail.
The Angie's List you know and trust is now Angie, and we're so much more than just a list. We still connect you with top local pros and show you ratings and reviews, but now we also let you compare upfront prices on hundreds of projects and book a service instantly. We can even handle the rest of your project from start to finish. So remember, Angie's List is now Angie, and we're here to get your job done right. Get started at Angie.com. That's A-N-G-I, or download the app today.
Delve into the shadows of the mind with Sleeping Dogs, a gripping murder mystery starring Academy Award winner Russell Crowe, now available on digital. Crowe portrays an ex-homicide detective unraveling a brutal murder he can't recall. Uncovering secrets from his past, he learns a chilling truth. It's best to let sleeping dogs lie. Visit sleepingdogsmovie.com/wondery to watch Sleeping Dogs, now on digital. That's sleepingdogsmovie.com/wondery.
And we're back. First, let's talk about some news. Cecilia has an interesting story. Maddie, why don't you tell us?
Sure. So Cecilia has been working on this story for Kotaku for months, I believe. It's this investigation she did about Niantic, which is the company that develops Pokemon Go and that Harry Potter game that I'm always playing. Mm-hmm. And it's very long. It's very interesting. It's about a lot of things we've talked about on this show, about the ways that they collect all of this data on players of those games, and they're able to observe a lot of information about them. And she's figured out some of the ways that they use that data. They obviously say they don't sell it to advertisers, which is what you'd worry about, but they have a lot of it. And to me, in reading that, my reaction was mostly just, okay, like, even if we assume that Niantic is only ever going to hold on to this data themselves and only use it to make wonderful video games, they've still opened up a world where it's normal to us to play games that operate in this way. And now we've all just accepted that that's like a cool thing a video game can do. And really any other company could make a game like this and it would already be normalized for this to be a way for a game to operate and for games to have this much information about our day-to-day lives. And that, I mean, we've talked about it on the show before. It's something I have a lot of mixed feelings about, even though I play those games. But I also go through weeks at a time where I don't play them at all because I feel mad at them. And then I'll start playing them again. So I don't know. It was just interesting for me personally to read this article and think about that again and be like, wow, the future is really weird. I carry a phone with me everywhere. The phone has location services on it and it knows where I am all the time. And advertisers want me to go to specific locations and do specific things there. And that creeps me out a little bit.
And every time there's a data breach at one of these companies, you think, ah, well, it's all well and good if they want to sit on my data and not use it for nefarious purposes.
And protect it, but like other people could.
Then they get hacked and suddenly someone just has all your location information for the past however
and
many
like
years.
Knows and, what time of day I go to CVS, knows when I'm sick because I'm going to CVS more, like knows all this information. It's creepy. But I'm still carrying my phone with me everywhere, so the joke's on me, I guess.
Joke's on all of us. Yeah, well, I haven't read that article yet, but I will definitely read it because it looks like quite a piece of work and very good work by Cecilia. So I'll check it out. Our next thing to talk about, I wanted to circle back to this Blizzard China situation. We talked about some last week. We had Joshua Rivera to talk about it. We covered some various, you know, various angles on it. I guess there have been some developments in the story since then that we should, I guess, mention. And then I had just a couple extra thoughts on it.
Sure.
Developments first. So, okay, let me see if I can remember them.
I can help you. Blizzard put out a statement, sort of a wishy-washy statement, where they allowed Blitzchung to keep his prize money, but they're still suspending him, I believe, for half the time.
Right, for half a year instead of a
Heather
year.
Just wrote an article right before we started recording about there were some college students who'd held up a sign protesting at a Hearthstone college tournament, and they've also been reprimanded by Blizzard in some way. So, I mean, they've been,
I believe, banned for 6 months as well. I think so, I saw that on Vice earlier this morning.
There have been a few sort of rumblings where also people are organizing some protests at BlizzCon, which hasn't happened yet. And we covered those early efforts where people want to be protesting these things and are planning to. It's an ongoing story. And I'm sure that tomorrow when this episode comes out, something else will have happened that we aren't including here, because it's in the news. It's continuing. The story continues.
Yeah, that does seem likely that something new will happen by the time people are listening to this from when we recorded it. A couple of thoughts I had. So one was, there was a thought that came to me as I was editing the episode last week when I was listening back to basically what I said to my own takes on it last
week. And you were like, this guy, what is he talking about?
Basically, And one listener did, he emailed a very thoughtful email being like, you know, there was this one thing that you didn't quite say that I was expecting you to say and wished you had. And I feel the same way. I was listening to it. I walked all the way up to it and then didn't say it. So basically, I was talking about how this is not exactly a free speech issue because this is Blizzard's right to do whatever they want, which is kind of the cover that this provides Blizzard, at least in terms of, you know, they have this policy and they can enforce it however they want because they're a private company. But the thing that I didn't fully articulate that is extremely true is that this is absolutely a free speech issue because another country, an authoritarian country, is imposing their own free speech restrictions on American citizens via pressure on Blizzard in this case. And that, I think, is a really worthwhile thing to point out, because that is, as 100 people have pointed out, you know, ever since this happened, and the thing with the NBA as well, and Apple and all these other companies, that's like the big flashing, it's not subtext, it's like that's the overarching narrative here, basically, is that by doing business with China in all these different ways, a bunch of companies are now subject to China's rules instead of America's rules, and non-Chinese citizens are being subject to the same thing.
It's true.
Which is pretty fucked up and worrying. So
it is, although it's also true, as you pointed out, that Blizzard and other companies that are capitulating in this way are saying that they're doing it to appeal to Chinese audiences who have a sort of cultural interest and are told by other people, like, you know, you should feel a certain way about Hong Kong. And, you know, companies that are trying to cater to those audiences might be like, well, we don't want to address this controversial issue because we want to appeal to more conservative Chinese viewers who maybe don't want to hear about these things and are used to not hearing about it in the entertainment that they consume, because that's just how things are. So that argument is shakier because it's like a free speech issue, but it's also the way that Blizzard and like League of Legends esports has also like put out that statement last week that that is a similar situation where they're like, we're just not going to talk about politics on our esports broadcast because we want to make sure to include everyone, and talking about politics can alienate people. And I don't know, it's this conversation has really driven me a little nuts because I'm also like, okay, but what's the worst case scenario here? Like, people keep being like, well, we don't want esports players to be coming out here and being like, go Trump. Like, yeah, okay, sure, we can all agree that would be annoying. But like, people do that in sports interviews. Like, people talk about what they think. That's a thing that we allow people to do here in America, is say their political views, even if they are not great. And obviously, people suffer for that sometimes, like Colin Kaepernick did, his career suffered. But like, we do actually allow people to talk about politics in many contexts here, and it is a thing that's okay. And if esports can't do that, that's sad to me, no matter what the reason is. So
yeah, I think so. I've been just doing a lot of sort of broader thinking about this or reading about it. This is like, it's not something, an area of total expertise for me, but I did like, so we'll link this in show notes. I liked Zeynep Tufekci's latest in The Atlantic that was basically wondering why China is reacting, why the Chinese government is reacting the way that they are, and trying to tease out, suss out a couple of reasons, which I just think is an interesting read. People should check it out. Something that I've thought about a little bit is, there are these different points of interaction with China that these three, that like, they're kind of these three axes that I see this on. There's Apple, there's the NBA, and there's Blizzard. And they're all a little bit different. Like Apple, their production is in China. So China has a ton of leverage over them because so many Apple devices are made in China. So if the Chinese government wants to say to Apple, hey, you know, in the case of Apple, it was this app that people were using in Hong Kong to track police to so they could know where to not go. And a lot of it, it sounds to me like, was just, I don't want to go somewhere and get accidentally tear gassed. Like, and it wasn't, you know, I think there was this way to, they were trying to portray it as, other people are using this to launch coordinated attacks on police. It sounds to me, at least, like that's not the case. But Apple pulled this app from the App Store, actually put it back, then pulled it again, I think is what happened. Because they, so they capitulated twice. And that's the point of leverage that the Chinese government has over them. In the case of the NBA, it's a little different, right? It's that the, what, they just, there's just, the NBA is really popular in China, and lots and lots of people watch the games, and they pulled all of those, you know, all the broadcasts. So that's a really different kind of pressure and a different relationship that the NBA has with China. They're not exactly like, you know, there aren't, all the players for the NBA aren't coming from China. And so now they have to consider, oh, if we don't, you know, want to, if we make China mad, we won't have any more players. It's not that direct of a connection. It's more a connection with the people, like you were talking about. The video game thing is interesting because in the case of Blizzard and in the case of Epic Games, which it hasn't come up yet, and I believe in the case of Riot, right? Riot is, what, owned by Tencent? Is that right? I think, or at least
I don't remember the percentage, but yeah.
So Chinese companies are actually buying video game companies or buying into them. So then it's like, you're on the board, and that's an even, that's another different relationship. All of this, I think, and I read, I think it was a Farhad Manjoo article in the New York Times about this, just, there was this belief that America and the internet would democratize China if it went in, and this authoritarian, you know, like information controlling, free speech quelling regime would not be able to stand up to the power of the internet. And apparently that unfortunately has not turned out to be the case. And it's the other way around. And they're like exporting this stuff to us. And that has been at least the overarching sort of takeaway that I've gotten from this, which is worrying and makes me think that these companies have a responsibility to actually live their values. And if it means taking a financial hit to do the at least to embody the values that they profess. You know, Blizzard has these values of you know, allowing people to speak and being inclusive. If you're working with a government that doesn't embody those values, you maybe have to stop if those values actually mean anything to you.
Yeah.
And that's kind of the conflict point that it seems like it's at right now.
Yeah, that's true. I just, one more thing is that a lot of esports views are Chinese views. Like, I've done a ton of research on this back in the compete days, and like worrying about audiences, I would say, is also a factor for Blizzard and Riot, even Epic for any esport. In that sense, I would say they are quite similar to the NBA.
Yes.
Like, in a way that maybe esports could pat themselves on the back for. Like, they finally have a very similar crisis to other sports in the sense that they now have to worry about Chinese audiences in the same way the NBA does over this.
Right.
I mean, we talked about Tencent last week, and I think that's still a factor, but I also think that these statements being like, we're worried about alienating audiences, I don't know that that's entirely a lie. I mean, I still think it's cowardly and that people should be able to say what they think on a broadcast, but that's because that's just a thing I think in general. I think people should be allowed to say what they think. But that as a reason, I at least buy on some level that that's the reason why Blizzard might be making this choice and might feel like they can't sacrifice the views of more conservative Chinese viewers who would want to enjoy these streams.
Yeah, I should say, yeah, each of those axes is like, there's a lot of overlap between them.
I'm not saying each
of these is exclusively the one thing. There's definitely overlap. And I mean, Apple, I'm sure, worries about Chinese customers as well. And there's, you know, all of these things.
That's like part of why it's so hard. And it's also part of why, like, yes, it's a free speech issue, but it's also very easy to kind of smoke screen up and be like, but it's also about these audiences and it's also about these other financial things. And there's many other reasons to do it besides this authoritarian government forcing us to do it, quote unquote. Like, you can kind of get around it, but that's also what's troubling about it as well. Anyway,
yeah, it's a whole thing, so we'll stay tuned. I'm sure we'll be talking about it for many weeks to come. That's the latest, though. And then the last thing I figured we should at least mention is this Fortnite black hole situation that happened. Is, you're probably up on this, I've been following it kind of loosely and just think that it's awesome, but what's the deal here?
Fortnite just went down for an entire day, a day that happened to be a vacation holiday for most young kids here in the United States on Monday. But that's because it had turned itself into a black hole. And this resulted in a very fun day of coverage for Kotaku's own Riley McLeod, because he could, you know, cover this absurd thing that has people who even don't play Fortnite talking about Fortnite. And not in a way of being like, oh, I'm annoyed at Fortnite, but like in a way of being like, wow, oh, I'm actually cool interested in what Fortnite is doing, like completely taking the game offline and then starting it all back up again and changing some things. It's very gimmicky, but it appears to have been a gimmick that worked really well and was entertaining to cover. So, you know, sometimes gimmicks, sometimes they're all right, I guess.
Yeah, so basically people were playing and the whole game got sucked into a black hole, and then you were just floating in outer space.
Well,
and then
there was a countdown to that happening. There's been an elaborate countdown, and people just thought it was going to be like the end of the season, because, you know, Fortnite operates according to these seasons where there are different things that are changed and updated in the game.
And I mean,
it was the
end of the season.
It was. Right? And the season ended with the game getting sucked into a black hole and then rebooting itself, essentially, which is a great way to end a season, you know?
Just it is.
Suck everything into a black hole for a while. Yeah.
It's such a flex, right? It's such a flex to say basically, oh yeah, we're just going to take our game offline for a day. Whatever. We're the biggest game in the world. No one can mess with us. And it worked. I mean, I feel like I was at least interested. I don't have the game downloaded right now, but I wanted to download it and at least
just
load
to
it
look
in,
at the
you
black
loaded
hole.
In.
Yeah.
Yeah, and you were floating in front of a black hole, and that's all the game was.
And you can't play
for
the game. You can't do anything. Man. You just look at the black hole.
That's pretty good.
It's very 2019. You can't do anything. You just look at the black hole. They really nailed it, you know?
they captured the aesthetic perfectly.
Yeah.
Nice. Well, that is very cool. And it didn't, I guess, quite get me to play Fortnite, but it almost did.
Almost.
All right.
They almost gotcha.
So we've got some listener mail we're going to go through now. A few people have been sending in their non-essential gaming traditions, as we'd been asking for a couple episodes ago. And those are very fun. First, we got a really fun email from listener Kevin about the Untitled Goose Game that I wanted to read.
Sure.
That I think puts forth a very compelling idea for video game language. Okay, Kevin writes, during your talk with Josh, the three of you touched on the amazing Untitled Goose Game, which was recently released. I have played this as well and also thoroughly love it. The ending is indeed perfect for the game. You then shifted focus toward Destiny and its sequel. I have not played these, and I have no real thoughts or opinions to share specifically about the Destinies. However, the community was briefly mentioned. Kirk said that Destiny community is generally great and positive, but it does have its share of assholes. Perhaps you can see where I'm going with this. Kevin, I will tell you, I did not see where you're going with this.
I did not
but
either.
Maybe listeners will. Okay, Kevin continues. In any case, I recommend that, effective immediately, we as gamers and game likers and game journalists the world over should begin referring to players who are assholes as geese. Some jerk taunting you about your armor? Just ignore that goose. Someone steal your killer resource? Man, that guy is such a goose. Is your teammate being toxic in chat because he's losing the game for the team? Report that goose. I like it because it is technically non-vulgar, which it allows it to be used in a much greater context than something like asshole, such as in the event that one is playing with younger people. I think that goose is a very good idea, Kevin. I am in favor of this in general. As he points out, geese are assholes. They're pretty much our kind of asshole birds, so it works. He doesn't want to insult geese, but I feel like maybe it's
they can take it. Yeah. Geese have been in power for far too long, as Untitled Goose Game shows.
It's true, and I feel like when I was a kid, people would be like, "Ah, you little goose!" Like
you
people
silly
would,
goose,
you silly goose. Yeah.
Thing I used
so now
to hear.
It's less silly and more. Ah, quit being such a goose. Mm-hmm, but I might actually start using that word. So, thanks for the suggestion, Kevin. If I start calling people a goose on this podcast,
now you'll know why.
You will know why. Okay, so let's read some video game tradition. Let's read some video game traditions. Maddie, why don't you start with Eric's tradition?
Eric writes, whenever I finish a game, I make a point to sit through the entire credit sequence start to finish. While this isn't a particularly weird or funny tradition, I find it is a good opportunity to decompress and reflect on the past 10, 20, or sometimes upwards of 100 hours I spent with a game. Similar to the mixed feelings of finishing a long novel or TV series, there's a sense both of loss and accomplishment when you finally reach the end of a game and have to say goodbye. This leads into my question. How do you feel about credit sequences in video games or other media, particularly now that credits are becoming more rare due to the rise of service games? Do you have any favorite credit sequences? Lastly, how do you deal with the sense of letdown when you complete a game or piece of media? I also try to watch an entire credit sequence. I don't know if you do that. I have no real reason for doing it other than some sense of obligation. Like I'm like, well, yeah. I enjoyed this entire game. I guess I should watch the credits and just sit here and enjoy it. And you know, Gears 4 did this thing where there was a post-credit scene. I don't know if you knew that. I don't think Gears 5 did, but Gears 4 has one, which is a very Marvel movie of them. I'm not
that
saying
is.
Games should start doing this. They shouldn't. But
maybe they should.
I don't know. Maybe they should. Maybe credit sequences should exist. But
yeah, I do like watching credit sequence. Actually, so I remember my Red Dead Redemption 2 review. Part of the review of that game was a review essentially
of
the experience of watching the credit sequence.
Right.
Because I made a big point of watching it and kind of internalizing all these people who'd worked on this, you know, bananas game.
They're so long. I mean, it's...
Yeah, they're very long. It can be cool, though. I think I agree with Eric's general vibe that even spending 20 minutes watching a credit sequence, if you just spent 80 hours on a game, that's not that big of a percentage. And it is kind of a good way to decompress and just take in how many people are involved in these games can be cool to do. A lot of times the music is good. I remember Tales from the Borderlands credit sequence played that First Aid Kit, My Silver Lining. And that was how I discovered that band. And it's a great song. Like that whole game had really great music, but that was a great song.
Anymore, I'm tired of looking for answers. Take me someplace where there's music and there's laughter. I don't know if
and actually the Cyanora Wildhearts credits, they're pretty short because not that many people made it, but it has a wonderful credits surprise at the end of the credits that knocked me out and that I really liked. So one more cool thing about that game. But yeah, I do. I like this. And I generally try to watch the credits as well.
Yeah.
All right. Next tradition comes from Keisuke, who writes, in Monster Hunter, I don't know if the community does this, but here's one that I do with my hunting team. When you successfully cut off a monster's tail, it's generally good multiplayer etiquette to wait until the monster leaves that area to go and carve it. This is to make sure you don't get mauled by the monster and spend one of the three precious feints that the quest would allow, and also to make sure you're contributing to the team's DPS. But we often do the complete opposite in my team, loudly proclaiming, combat carve, as a few of us would immediately dash over toward the freshly cut tail and reckless disregard for our hunter's well-being. At this point, it's about locking eyes with the monster as we carve up its tail, establishing dominance in the most primal of ways. Though more often than not, we're terrified of the repercussions, hoping our transgressions go unnoticed. Hopefully, our helpless cries of, no, 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 don't look this way, mostly go unanswered by the monster, or rather answered very physically via vicious chomps and full-body tackles. It's all great fun, but don't do this in random online groups for obvious reasons. I like this advice. I've definitely done this where I'm like, I'm just carving the tail now, fuck it. And I just go for it while everyone else is still fighting. And I know that makes me a bad teammate, but
that's really funny.
Yeah, the calling out combat carve, and everyone just goes in
like as though it's something that anyone does. Like, you know, it's a combat carve. That's what it's called when you do that.
Go get it done. Great stuff. Very good tradition.
All right. So Dino writes, in Elder Scrolls games, if I become a vampire, my life's quest changes to rid the world of silver. All silver, any silver. For example, in Oblivion, I had my dockhouse filled to the brim with silver plates, goblets, swords, etc., to the point where a junk explosion would occur when entering the house. The inconvenience of making a stash house unusable is worth making the world a little safer for myself and vampire kin.
I enjoy that very
much. It is enjoyable. I don't know if there's like garlic or wooden crosses or anything else you need to collect as well. I don't know. The Elder Scrolls doesn't really have that stuff. It'd be cool, but...
or like whether it would even do anything, but
it wouldn't. I mean, that I know of.
I've never become a vampire in those games. Like, I know you can, and it's always this touted thing. You can become a werewolf, maybe, in some of them. But I'm always like, I don't want to mess up my perfect guy. I feel like I wind up playing safer characters. I should be.
You should create a side character who just makes a lot of mistakes. I mean, I never do that. I always think I'm going to do that in a game. Right, like, have some extra character who's like allowed to be a complete jerk or like just screw up their life. But I've never actually done it. I should though.
Same. Yeah. All right. I like that one. Okay. Next one is from Travis. Travis writes, so my friends and I have this tradition when we were playing Diablo 3. There is this really awful pair of legendary boots that drop all the time called Iron Toe Mud Sputters. Iron Toe Mud Sputters. Say that 10 times fast. Anyways, every time we want to run in some rifts or do whatever we were doing, we would take all the mud sputters that we have ever had drop for that season and fill the town with these awful boots. After a while, we'd have enough that you wouldn't be able to see the town, basically. To make this even more funny, we would open these rooms up to the public and have blueberries join and be very confused. I enjoy this as well. I like any tradition that involves just stacking shit so high that it just covers the entire game. It's maybe that's one reason the Untitled Goose Game is so good.
It is great. Yeah, because it remembers where you stacked things. I've never done this in Diablo 3, and I didn't even know you could do this.
No,
and
me
still
neither.
Have it actually work, and like the things would stick around, and it wouldn't break the game. That's amazing. I feel like the Elder Scrolls example is something that I hear about people doing all the time.
Right.
Not enough Diablo 3 stacking. People should be stacking stuff more in that game.
It seems that way. I didn't know it was possible either. It is. All right, you want to read this last one?
Sure. So it's from someone who goes by The Tap. Apparently. Mm-hmm. Cool name.
It is.
And they write, my favorite video game tradition is one that I've developed with my streaming community. Every month we have a game night where we play multiplayer games and hop on voice call together. Whenever we play Mario Kart 8, we have a house rule that if we land on the map Mute City, only the person in first place can talk. It leads to so many hilarious situations where the person in first place feels the pressure to fill dead air while still maintaining their placing. It's easily my new favorite way to play Mario Kart. This rules.
I love this tradition.
I want other people to do this.
it makes me want to do it. Being in first place and needing to fill dead air, which is also funny as like a something.
Because you're streaming as well. If it's part of a stream, then you actually do kind of need to fill the dead air so you can like entertain people who are watching it. That's really, really great.
And so everyone's gunning for you and they're all consciously not talking and biting their tongues as they try to get you. And you're sitting there just being like, ha ha ha, ha you're not going to get me. Anyway, and you feel this pressure to talk. And I just think it's a very fun way of messing with the person who's in first place. As if being in first place in Mario Kart didn't suck enough.
God,
have a banana peel and also you're the only one who can talk. So banana peel and awkwardness.
I'm sure that they're switching out who's in first place fairly consistently based on this rule. So it probably means that different people are swapping between talking, which
You ask someone a question and then purposefully let them pass you so they can answer.
Or you can purposefully troll people and they can't answer you or talk to you unless they manage to catch up to you. Seems great. Seems like a great way to play a game.
It's a good one. So thanks again to everybody who sent these in. Even the ones we didn't get to read were enjoyable. And if you have any more, keep them coming.
Send them in. They're great.
We definitely read all of our emails, splitscreen@kotaku.com, even if we don't reply to everybody. We appreciate everyone who writes in. All right, why don't we take another break and we'll be back with some off-topic discussion.
CarMax is putting peace of mind back in car shopping by putting you in the driver's seat to find a ride that's right for you. Because at CarMax, we believe you shouldn't just settle for a car. You should love your car. That's why every car we sell is CarMax certified quality, so you can be sure with upfront pricing that's the same for every customer. So don't settle. Find love at first drive and start shopping now at CarMax.com. CarMax, the way car buying should be.
All right, and we're back. Time to talk about some things that are not video games. Maddie, what is your non-video game thing to talk about?
Well, I read a book. Technically,
yay,
I listened
books
to
are great.
An audiobook, which is kind of like reading a book,
oh,
but
nice.
Not quite. So I listened to the audiobook for this book called Educated by Tara Westover, which you talked about a few weeks back, and your recommendation plus just a few other people I knew recommended it. And I was like, all right, fine. It's a bestseller. A lot of people have probably already heard about it by now, but I finally read it and that's what matters. So it's a memoir. So Tara Westover grew up with a father who's a prepper. He's a Mormon, but he's also just like an apocalypse-fearing prepper, which I think is actually more of an influence on her entire life than the fact that he's also a Mormon. There's obviously like a religious upbringing that she dealt with, but I know Mormons who are not even close to on the level of what this guy did in terms
kind of
how he raised his family. It's like
Mormonism.
His own, it's like his own perception of the world. And he sort of led his family in this very particular way that, like, he over time stopped letting his children go to school. Like, the first couple kids were allowed to, but then Tara and her younger siblings couldn't go. And she, therefore, and she didn't have a birth certificate until like very late in life, doesn't know exactly when her birthday was, doesn't like have access to all sorts of institutional paperwork that she needs in order to be a part of society, because her father is afraid of the government and didn't want society to have those records on his family, and lived in fear of the feds coming and finding them and trying to kill them all. And that was like the environment that she grew up in. And she just had this very scary childhood as well, where there's like a lot of abuse and neglect that's described, that you read the book and you worry that she is going to die at a lot of points because she's in intense physical danger. But you know that she cannot die because she has written the book. And so, like, anytime something really horrible was happening to her, I'd just have to be like, it's okay, Maddie. You know she's going to make it out of this. Like, I would, like, Google image pictures of her and be like, she looks healthy. She doesn't look, she's not, like, missing limbs. Like, I, like, spoiled the book for myself in that sense because I was just so worried about her physical health at so many points in this book. So that is kind of a warning. Like, there's a lot of physical abuse and emotional abuse in the book that's described. But it was really fascinating to me to hear from somebody who was raised in, it's not even just a conservative environment, it's like an environment where, like, people were bigoted but also were just lying to her about, like, a lot of basic facts, and, like, lying by omission about a lot of, like, historical events that happened. Like, she didn't know about the Holocaust until she finally eventually got to college and had to get there by herself, by studying on her own. And just things like that, like the fact that she learned about those things and was open-minded about them as an adult and ended up with fairly progressive politics was, like, kind of amazing and wonderful to me, that that's even something that can happen. And yeah, I found that to be a really fascinating other part of the book, like her describing learning about things for the first time and changing her mind.
Yeah, I like that part a lot.
I don't know. I'd never read a book from somebody who'd done that. And I think a lot about what makes people change their mind if they're in that type of position where they're, like, raised in a bigoted household, and, like, can people change and can you get through to them? And so this book is almost hopeful in that regard, even though it's also very sad. So yeah, I recommend it. And I promise I didn't spoil all the good things about it, even by revealing all of that.
It's kind of unspoilable, right?
Yeah, for sure.
Yeah, she's a great writer. And I think, I find her very interesting and inspiring in that way, too. Just that she became this exceptional person through an exceptionally dark and difficult childhood.
Right.
Which is cool. You know, it's interesting that there are aspects of this that overlap with Bundyville, with that podcast that I was talking about a couple weeks ago, which is just a great show about Clive and Bundy and the Bundy Ranch. The first season is, and the second season kind of takes on the Patriot movement. I've talked about this on the show.
Mm-hmm.
It's a lot, though, about, like, sort of more Western political movements. And there's a thread that ties Mormonism back to the Bundys as well, because a lot of Mormons were persecuted by the federal government for a long time, or saw themselves as persecuted because of polygamy and other things. So then they weren't allowed to have land and were kicked out. And so there's this like deep distrust of the government that her father also has. And
some of it is based in reality, but then obviously his paranoia is like far afield of the actual reality. Yeah.
Mm-hmm. So that stuff ties in then a lot. As I was listening to Bundyville and the stories of very different people, it gives more portraits of more people in the West and it helped me understand that sort of mindset and where that stuff comes from and how it can become so extreme.
Yeah.
So it's a good kind of counterpoint or counterpart, I guess, to Educated. But yeah, Educated. Does she read the audiobook? Is she the
it's some actress who was very good. I did think the audiobook was very good. She doesn't read it though. Right.
That's cool.
So what are you interacting with that's not a video game?
My things are also books.
Yay,
I finished
reading.
A couple of books. Reading is great. So I finished Green Mars, the second book in Kim Stanley Robinson's Mars trilogy. I feel like I didn't do the book justice when I talked about it last time because I made it sound kind of like a challenging read or something. But this book is amazing. This trilogy is amazing. I mean, they always take a while to build up ahead of steam because they're very long and very dense. But man, once they get going, it's such a great story. I'm still, I guess I haven't Googled this, but if someone isn't trying to pitch a like HBO treatment of this trilogy, I don't know what
I'm sure someone is. I'm sure several someone's are out there trying to make it
happen.
It
would just, the characters and the stories, the politics, how it's so dense and rich and good. So anyways, I finished that. It was very, very cool. I'm definitely going to read Blue Mars, which is the conclusion of the trilogy, and not maybe right away. I'm going to give it a minute just because they're very long books and it was quite a read, but I kind of want to read them all from the beginning as well, because one thing that happens in these books is the main characters stay the main characters throughout the books. This isn't really a major spoiler or anything, but they, pretty early on, there's a treatment that they can take that lets them live a very, very long time, because this is in the future. And so you get the same characters maintaining, you know, their protagonist status through a generational, you know, books that really cover, you know, a very, very long time. I think the main characters are like 180 years old now at this point. So it lets it's like an epic. It's kind of a generational epic, but
with one
there
person.
Are new characters that are introduced, but the same characters are still there as well. And it deals with memory, especially the later parts of Green Mars, where they can't remember things as well as they used to be able to. And memory is kind of the one thing the treatment hasn't nailed. So they're still physically okay, but they're, you know, they look elderly, but they don't remember things. And you don't remember things too, because the books are just very long and it's been a long time since I read the first book. So I have there's a part where this character is really struggling to remember this thing that I also couldn't remember. And it was such an amazing part of like just feeling this kind of connection with the protagonist. And anyways, really good book. So recommend that. The other thing, I just finished my reread of Why the Last Man, the 10-part, you know, Brian K. Vaughan his big saga. And I gotta say, okay, so they're making this into a TV show.
They
I don't
are.
Remember what network.
Me either, but I know it's happening.
I know it's happening, and the thing that made me think of it was that Charlie Jane Anders, my former, forever ago, IO9 editor, and just wonderful person, she's the best, and a great writer, she's on the writing staff for the show. And I saw her tweet that and thought, oh, well, that's cool, and I should reread Why the Last Man. So that was kind of what got me to reread it. I'm going to say this. Okay, the books are not as good as I remembered. They're good. It's a great story and a very interesting story. It has a lot of cool twists and turns. I like the art a lot. I like, you know, generally dig it. And the ending is devastating. Have you read Why the Last Man? I can't remember.
I did, but ages and ages
ago. A long time ago.
Okay, so cool. I definitely haven't reread it recently enough to have the experience
have
that
take.
I'm sure
but
you're
you
having.
But you know the ending at least. Like the ending definitely is very, very strong. It ends ultra strong. But like, I think that the characters are actually fairly thin and a lot of the relationships aren't actually all that fleshed out. I found myself wanting a lot more from it. It moves very, very quickly, which is cool. It covers tons of ground, and in between each volume, there will be all this, like, you know, time will have passed and years will pass and characters will, like, their relationships will change, and you'll kind of get a sense of what's happened just between the lines. And it's fine that they don't spell everything out for you all the time, but it felt actually a little bit thin to me by the end in a way that is not actually a knock against the book. It's still like a really entertaining and cool story. story, but it did make me think, you know, I bet a TV show with actors portraying these characters, if it's well done, could fill in a lot of these gaps in a really cool way. So it made me more excited for the TV show. It didn't like make me retroactively dislike the books or anything. I was just a little bit like, oh, this is a little bit thinner and a little bit more surfacey, at least with the supporting cast. And even some jumps that the characters make that Yorick makes throughout the book, then I kind of had remembered, or maybe I'd filled it in my own head. So it was interesting. It was cool to reread it and not come away thinking, wow, it totally holds up. Like, it's great. There's some room for a show to do some cool stuff. So
I do think there's room for like a really good adaptation of Why the Last Man. I feel like there's some pretty obvious problems with that book and like trans people. And I've always been like super curious but I think a modern version of it could probably tackle that and be really interesting. And like,
I started reading Watchmen. I didn't mention this,
but wait, have you never read Watchmen before?
I'm sorry, rereading Watchmen.
Okay.
Which is another one I haven't read in a long time.
Also so. About to be a show that I'm very curious about as well. Yeah. Watchmen, the trailers look really weird and it could suck, but it also looks like a situation where they're modernizing some aspects of the core themes of Watchmen in ways that could suck ass or be interesting. And I'm sort of tentatively hopeful about both of those adaptations still.
Yeah, Watchmen is interesting. I'm hearing really good buzz on it. The people I know who have seen the first six episodes say it's good. And because it takes place after the book, which is smart because the book itself, rereading the book, that book is ultra impressive. I mean, it's very 1980s, but reading it now, I'm even more
it's
struck
still pretty
by
good.
How,
yeah.
holy shit, yeah. I mean, just the way they do concurrent storytelling and each frame will, like, there are always concurrent storylines going. And I remember at the time reading that book, I guess I'm talking about Watchmen. We've got a little time. I remember reading that book for the first time, the scenes with Dr. Manhattan where he is actually existing in multiple timelines at once, and thinking, oh, this is a comics thing that only comics can do. That way that when you play a video game and it does something that only video games can do, and you think, oh, this is cool. It's like a moment of sort of, medium frisson or something. I don't know what you'd call it. Like when the specific media like allows for something that only it can do.
Right.
And with comics, it was very like, oh, I'm looking at this page and these things are laid out in, and I can look at them in any order. And that lets me like feel the experience that he's describing in a way that nothing else really could. But the whole book is that way. And I don't think I really internalized that. I think I just wasn't old enough the first time I read this. I just have a completely different view of politics and the world. My understanding of the 1980s is so different. And so reading this kind of post-Cold War, Cold War thing, it's so drenched in that stuff. And then just paying attention to the details of the art and the way that they're mirroring things and following like each character and going from people standing at a funeral to people each remembering the guy in order and like telling this complete complex story of this dude. And like, man, it's very impressive. Also, like, Rorschach doesn't seem cool to me this time. He just seems
I don't think he was ever actually supposed to be cool, though.
Right, I don't think so either.
It's just one of those weird misinterpretations where Rorschach was like interpreted as cool by like a certain subset of people, and then
because it's like the irony of reading the book and thinking, oh, I want there to be a cool hero.
Yes, but there isn't one. That's the whole point of Watchmen.
No,
is
exactly,
none of them
like
are
the
cool.
Point.
They're all wildly uncool.
But like when you start the book, especially at the beginning, because Rorschach features pretty heavily in the beginning, he's the only one doing cool hero shit at all. Like he uses a grappling hook to go up to a guy's balcony. Like he gets in a fight at a bar and beats a guy up. And so you're like, okay, well, I guess he's the superhero. And if you're not getting that the whole point of the book is like heroes are, these people are all terrible and like, you know, each have their own problems, you would cling on to it. That's what makes me think when I read it, I was too young. And I'm very interested to keep going and read through it and before the show. And then I'm very interested in the show. So I'll probably do an actual off topic on that when I've finished reading.
I probably will too. Comics.
I think it's, comics, they're good.
Good
shit. They're very good. Music is also good.
It's true, it is.
I'm going to do, so my music pick, I guess, is predictable. First of all, Strong Songs this week is Kiss from a Rose by Seal.
Oh my God. Great.
Oh yeah. And that was a really fun episode to make. And people should go listen to it if they want to hear.
I will.
That song is awesome in so many ways. It was a really fun episode to make. It took me back and it was a fun tune to learn. It does things that a lot of songs don't do. So that was really cool.
Great.
And I dug it a lot. But my music pick, I think I'm just going to go with something from the Sayonara Wild Hearts soundtrack. So this is one of the first tracks that plays from that soundtrack, which is a killer soundtrack on its own. This is a tune called Begin Again, written by Daniel Olson and Jonathan Ng, featuring Linnea Olson. And here's a clip of that. You know, video, it's a great video game. It's, I would say the music is best experienced with the game,
within
but
the
I've
game?
Been listening to it nonstop as well. And it's,
All right. Really good. You sold me on it. I'll get it. I'll get this video game. I'll check it out.
You will. Yeah. It's 90 minutes well spent. I wish I could forget it and just play it again, but I'm probably just going to play it again anyways. Just turn up the volume for sure.
Mm-hmm. Cool.
All right. Well, that's another one. That's another one for the record books.
We did another show.
We made it through. So let's go play some video games, and I will talk to you in a week, Maddie.
You will. Bye.
Kotaku Split Screen is the official podcast of Kotaku.com. It's produced by Jason Schreier, Maddie Myers, and me, Kirk Hamilton. I edit and mix the podcast and also wrote and performed our theme song and other music. You can find us on most popular podcast services, and we hope you'll leave us a review if you like what you hear. Find old episodes at kotaku.com/splitscreen. Email us at splitscreen@kotaku.com.